On the 6th of March, 1413, there was an important meeting taking place in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. It was a convocation, a gathering of theologians and bishops of the Catholic Church in England who had come to discuss the growing problem of the Lollard heresy. To these men, it seemed to be a growing danger, a silent force rising in numbers and profile. They were meeting as part of an ecclesiastical attempt to comprehensively destroy this group, and they were to consider 267 separate heretical articles drawn from the writings of the founder of the Lollard movement, a man called John Wycliffe, and they were to write to the Pope asking him to confirm their sentences upon the man and his work and his followers. That day was the first day of the convocation, and as the clerics were gathering and meeting, something extraordinary happened. There, mingling in the crowd, watching them all, was a known suspected Lollard. His name was John Lay, a chaplain from Nottingham who just happened to be visiting London. His appearance surprised the gathered theologians. He was heavily suspected of heresy, and they could not work out if he was being stupid by turning up, or if he was displaying disdain for their august proceedings. It was rumoured that earlier that day he had celebrated Mass with the new national leader of the Lollards. Spluttering in indignation, they demanded John Lay appear before them and bombarded him with questions. Lay seemed relaxed, almost easygoing. When they asked him to produce his certificate of ordination, which gave him the license to celebrate Mass, he calmly said he did not have those documents on him right this second. They furiously demanded he go and get them and return to them on the following Saturday. There is no record if he ever did that. That tiny moment of John Lay being confronted in St. Paul's Cathedral is where we start this episode, and we begin with this because it's worth noting that within a year, the Lollards of England would stage an uprising, a violent attempt to assassinate the King of England. And here, in the months just before it happens, one of their members with links to the leadership who will make that decision is not hiding or skulking. He is walking as bold as brass into the very heart of the enemy camp. He is not panicked nor worried when he is seen. He does not shout or condemn. He is cool, nonchalant, calm, flippant even. There's a bravado here, but given the circumstances, it's not just bravado. This seems to be faith. And when I say faith, I don't just mean faith in the doctrines he holds, but it appears to be a faith in his fellow Lollard. Faith that their time had come, that they were in the ascendancy. Within a year, there was to be an attempt to kill the king and reshape the nature of England by a bunch of religious extremists. And you cannot help but see that up until the very last moment, some of them believed they were going to win. And it is the postulation of this episode that that belief they were going to win was born out of the fact that they were fairly sure that London, as a city, was with them. That the city was about to erupt into a force of angry violence like it had during the Peasants' Revolt, and that led by them, they would gain victory over the new unproven king. Now, I'm not saying their perceptions were realistic or had any chance of actually happening, but I am suggesting that it does appear that they thought they did have a chance, that they thought London was behind them. And the story of John Lay as cool as anything in St. Paul's Cathedral is suggestive of just that. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city, covering events from the point of view of the residents at the time. This is the second part of the saga of the Lollards of London, and while last episode we tracked the history of this group in London over the last 30 years, this episode, well, all of that comes to fruition, as we describe the attempt by the Lollards to basically try and wipe out several members of the royal family. Welcome then to chapter 148 of the story of London, Oldcastle's Rebellion. To begin this episode, we need to talk about the man who this episode is named after, Sir John Oldcastle. Who is he? Well, Sir John was born in Herefordshire, possibly around 1370. He was a son of a lower-ranked member of the gentry, and we know by around 1400, he was certainly serving as a knight and soldier up in expeditions in Scotland. Having cut his teeth there, he ended up making his name fighting much closer to home, in Wales. Here he was seen as a commander of some respect and was placed in charge of garrisons and castles and gained a reputation as a competent and cool captain. By the year 1404, when he wasn't in action in battle, he was serving as an MP for Herefordshire in Parliament that year, and he went on to become a Justice of the Peace and then High Sheriff for Herefordshire in 1406 and 1407. It was in 1407 that he first met Prince Henry of Monmouth, the Prince of Wales, the future Henry V. On May the 12th of that year, the young teenage prince arrived in South Wales with 200 men-at-arms and 600 archers. And 2 months later, he led this force, plus other forces who had supplemented him, to stand before the walls of Aberystwyth Castle. Included in his commanders and captains at this time were men who he used to make firm friendships with. The Duke of York, the Earl of Warwick, John Talbot, Lord Carew, and Sir John Oldcastle. What must be understood was that Shropshire and Herefordshire were counties that stood to suffer way more than most of the others from the threat of Welsh incursions, and because of this, they provided the prince with quite a large number of followers. And therefore, Oldcastle, as a captain from Herefordshire, became one of the more important local leaders of the prince's forces. He fought alongside him, advised him, obeyed orders, was dependable and trustworthy. What we see looking at the young prince around then was that from an early age he liked soldiers whose loyalty he could depend upon, whose bravery he could rely, and who he was ready to reward with favour and trusted position. Oldcastle became one of them. Sir John's life then followed its own momentum. He had married twice, and we assume his wives had died, because in 1408 he married a woman called Joan, the heiress to the estate of Cobham in Kent. This resulted in a significant improvement in Oldcastle's fortunes, as the Cobhams were, quote, one of the most notable families of Kent, unquote. And because of the marriage, he ended up owning manors up in Norfolk, over in Northamptonshire, Wiltshire, and above all, owned the rather impressive Cooling Castle in Kent. From now on, Oldcastle attended Parliament from the years 1409 to 1413 as Lord Cobham. By 1411, however, he is still one of the soldiers helping out in the war effort. He is stationed with Prince Henry's brother in the south of France, fighting alongside the royal family. He is, by all accounts, an establishment figure, a soldier, a respectable loyalist, liked personally by the king, who just had a crown placed upon his head. Oldcastle is a man of action, a captain of the Lancasterian armed forces, one of the most effective fighting machines in Europe at this time. And he was also a Lollard. Now, it should not come as too much of a surprise. The Lollard movement was strong in Herefordshire, and by 1410 it was less inclined to the wild ravings of extremists like John Bull, who used to give religious objections to the existence of nobility in the first place. Here in Herefordshire, it was found in men and women who found the traditions of the Catholic Church to be filled with unnecessary ritual, self-appointed later doctrine, and ultimately, people who embraced Wycliffe's desire for reform. We know Oldcastle was certainly a Lollard by the year 1410, as the churches in the estates owned by his wife in Kent were suddenly placed under interdiction for allowing unlicensed preaching. The Lollards were finding places to spread their word under his patronage, and it needed to be stopped. Oldcastle, because of his wealth and his position, soon gravitated towards the position as leader of the Lollards. And so, by March 1413, we have that gathering in St. Paul's Cathedral, London, to discuss the Lollards and their leaders, the one which John Lay was hovering about in. These men were watching the Lollards of London. Their perception was that the Lollards in the city were growing in number. The appearance of John Lay from Nottingham that March suggested a group who had recovered from the burning of members a decade earlier, and they were now in the position where they could be supplemented by out-of-town preachers coming to meet with their local practitioners, and that there was nothing anybody could do to seemingly stop their growth. And Oldcastle was increasingly being seen as a leading figure within this group. The convocation ordered the secular authorities to start searching for evidence, and this led to them to search an illuminator's shop in Paternoster Row in London. When they were there, they discovered some incriminating documents, quote, in four unbound volumes containing several small and very dangerous treatises aimed at the subversion of our faith and the church, unquote. Now, we really don't know if the illuminator in question, who lived on Paternoster Row, was himself suspected of heresy, or what other reasons the authority had for searching his shop. But upon questioning by the authorities, the illuminator revealed that these offending documents found in his shop belonged to Sir John Oldcastle. The illuminator's confession gave the convocation a most important tool to use against the knight, and they were not slow to make use of it. In early June, these documents, together with another bunch from Coventry and copies of the 267 conclusions extracted from the writings of John Wycliffe, were publicly burnt in a grand ceremony at St. Paul's Cross, while the Archbishop of Canterbury explained the reason for their destruction to the watching, expectant crowd. Later the same day, a deputation was sent to visit the King with his court, where, in the presence of Sir John Oldcastle and many others, this deputation read aloud the most heretical points taken from the documents supposedly owned by Sir John Oldcastle. This caused outrage and shock, and the King expressed horror. But despite this revelation, nothing was directly done. The King seemed reluctant to act upon this most trustworthy of his captains. Meanwhile, in response to that public burning of their Lollard documents, between June and August 1413, London's Lollards retaliated by fixing bills to the church porches of London, which presented their side of the case and apparently threatened retribution. According to one source at the time, these documents, quote, they contained 100,000 ready to rise up against all those who did not respect their sect, unquote. So as well as they had in the past, resorted to theological arguments, suddenly we start seeing a threat being made. In response to this, the convocation proceeded against John Claydon, one of the leaders of the London congregation who we mentioned last chapter. It was after weeks of this game of threat and counter-threat that we get to the third week in August 1413, and the Archbishop Arundel finally persuaded King Henry V to allow him begin proceedings against his old friend and comrade at arms. Oldcastle was arrested and brought for trial at St. Paul's Cathedral. Apart from the fact that he was allowed to abjure the trial for a few weeks, nothing is known of the circumstances of this trial. On the 21st of August, 1413, shortly after this, a royal writ was sent to all the sheriffs of England, including those of London, ordering them to make proclamation against heretical preaching and the holding of illegal conventicles, since the government had heard that many unlicensed chaplains, quote, of the new sect of Lollards, unquote, were teaching in public places and stirring up great multitudes of people to murmuring and sedition. Certainly, they are moving against Oldcastle, and they begin to see, or suspect, that the Lollard movement is much larger than was previously thought. We have no details about how the Lollards of the city responded directly to this at first, but we do know Oldcastle's trial began around the 23rd of September, during which one of the charges made against him was that he had been a, quote, receiver, supporter, protector, and defender of the Lollards in the Diocese of London, unquote. Oldcastle was very quickly condemned to be handed over to the secular powers that be as a heretic on the 25th of September. But even with that, King Henry V was loyal to that dutiful and hard-fighting captain of his. He persuaded the Archbishop to grant a stay of execution for 40 days in the hope that Sir John might recant and spare himself. And so, accordingly, Oldcastle was committed to the Tower of London. According to one bishop, however, Oldcastle contrived to remain in contact with the London community of heretics and asked them to make copies of a bill, quote, to be set up in diverse quarters of London, that the people should not believe the slanders and lies that his enemies, the bishops, servants and priests, had made of him, unquote. The bill Oldcastle had ordered placed around London was written in English, and in it he insisted he was unrightfully convicted and imprisoned, and that the official account of what had gone on was nothing but a pack of lies. He refuted their version of things, and he does appear in this document to be weakening in his resolve, suggesting that Henry V's tactics were working. This bill was worded brilliantly. It suggested that the formal account of his trial was not to be trusted, and that the clergy were just conducting a witch hunt. This actually worked, and one bishop wrote that his claim cast doubt amidst the teeming population of London. So while he was making the Londoners begin to fear that the out-of-town clergy were just conducting a witch hunt, he was also seemed to be submitting to the will of the king and showing everything was a misunderstanding, and he was ready to recant his beliefs. At least one contemporary commentator at the time felt that John Oldcastle was playing a brilliant game, giving the impression that his resolve was weakening simply in order to gain more freedom within the grounds of the Tower of London, that he'd still remain in custody and behind the walls, but he was no longer locked in a cell. And the thing is, that's exactly what happened. This tactic of seeming contrite worked. As one witness of the time says, quote, towards the end of October, that evasive man was released from his bounds on the promise that he would retract his heretical opinions and stand trial before the church. He was then held in custody until he could appear before the tribunal of summoning the clergy. He broke out of prison and fled, unquote. The circumstances of Sir John Oldcastle's amazing escape from the Tower are actually not precisely known, as most of the chronicles simply say he just broke away from prison and went away. John Stowe, writing some centuries later, records that he'd read that he'd escaped at night, and another even later account does state that no other prisoners escaped with him. The 16th century writer, Robert Redmayne, probably drawing on an earlier chronicle, suggests he got away, quote, either he was sheltered and aided by the protection of his friends, or by the treachery of those who were appointed as his guards, of whom he had corrupted with the hope of rewards and the greatness of his money, unquote. I'll be honest with you, that seems to be the closest and most reasonable explanation as to how Oldcastle escaped. I mean, certainly the officials of the Tower were not above suspicion, and the previous July, there'd been another important political prisoner who had managed to escape with the connivance of two minor Tower functionaries. But whether or not Oldcastle had bribed his guards, there is no doubt that his escape was effected with the help of his London supporters, with whom, according to at least one bishop, he'd been in contact with during the entire time of his imprisonment. The ringleader of his escape plans seems to have been a man called William Parchmaner, and from the record of whose trial in 1416, we do get the only concrete information we do have about the escape. Parchmaner and other traitors, whose names were not known to the jury, had met at his house in the parish of St. Sepulchre's, Smithfield, on October 19th, and, presumably by night, quote, did go privily to the tower aforesaid, and break into that tower, and falsely and traitorously withdrew the same John Oldcastle therefrom, and take him from thence to his own dwelling house in the parish of St. Sepulchre's, and did falsely and traitorously harbour him there in such dwelling house until the Wednesday next after Epiphany, unquote. None of the name of Parchmaner's accomplices are known for certain, but they probably included a London tailor, Richard Roth, who becomes important in a moment, and he probably also had the help of three of his neighbours from Turnell Street, Clerkenwell, who were involved in later violence, and probably with help from members of Oldcastle's personal household. Of William Parchmaner's life before 1413, we know nothing that is certain. But there is no reason to disbelieve the statement that Oldcastle remained in the house in Smithfield for the whole period between his escape from the Tower of London and round about the evening of the 6th of January 1414. Now, for reasons we can only guess at, the government themselves appear to have waited for nearly 10 days before breaking the news of the escape. It was not until then that Sir Robert Morley, the keeper of the prisoners of the Tower, was removed from office for his negligence, and on the same day, the sheriffs of London were ordered to make a proclamation which forbade anyone from helping or harbouring Oldcastle. The interesting thing is no record exists of such a writ being sent to any other sheriffs or county in the country. And it's possible that the government knew Sir John was still in London somewhere, although it was extremely doubtful if they knew his exact whereabouts. The fugitive and all his followers and supporters were solemnly and publicly excommunicated in a ceremony on St. Paul's Cross on the 10th of December by the Archbishop of Canterbury and some of his suffragans. Doubtless the government took other measures against the Lollards during the closing months of 1413, but unfortunately we know nothing of them. There was a case where some anonymous supporters of Oldcastle do seem to have been imprisoned in the Tower by the end of November, and this is where we come to that name of a London tailor called Richard Roth. See, apparently, right about the 26th of November, Richard Roth sent his wife in the prison to speak to several prisoners who appear to have been jailed for being Lollards. Mistress Roth, when she went in, was overheard declaring that the judgment given against Sir John Oldcastle was altogether against divine law, and that Sir John was a strong knight of God, falsely condemned by the ministers of the Antichrist. Because of this, Roth was arrested and imprisoned, and not only named as a Lollard, he was also named as one who was privy to St. John's escape from the Tower. We have little detailed information concerning the activity of the Lollards in London during the period between Oldcastle's escape from the Tower and the outbreak of the revolt. During this time, Sir John Oldcastle had obviously come to a decision. He was ultimately, despite being the leader of the Lollards, no theologian. He was a soldier, a man of action, a man of battle. Somewhere along the lines, Oldcastle had realised that the only way he gets out of this alive is by escalating up. The only way out is with violence. Oldcastle, no doubt still operating from Parchmaner's house up in Smithfield, made his plans, and he sent out messengers to Lollard congregations all over England. He decided that the die was cast. He was going to strike out. The Lollard heresy had one chance to survive by attacking the regime itself. He sent word to Lollards around England to gather to him. The captain needed troops to rise up. Quote, Lollard messages were running from all sides and would entice the peasants and whoever they could with excessive promises of stipends, unquote. For practical and obvious reasons, it seems likely that most of the messengers sent out to the outlying congregations of Lollards were Londoners. Of course, most of the actual recruitment of rebels seemed to be carried out by local leaders, but words of the plan and words of the muster were carried by London to the Lollards across England. The plan was for the Lollards and the supporters of Sir John Oldcastle to gather together on the evening of the 9th and 10th of January in 1414 at St. Giles Field, an open space outside the city walls near the present site of Lincoln's Inn. An armed insurrection was to begin. But Oldcastle wasn't stupid. He was a captain. He'd seen battle. He knew, even if all the lords came together, they wouldn't be powerful enough to stand against the king. No. The gathering of the lords was the second part of his plan. The first part would be to place it so that nobody would be able to move against the lords. The first part was much more dangerous. Oldcastle arranged for a small body of fanatical, hand-picked lollards to dress up as mummers, or performers of mummers' plays, actors. And they were to go to Eltham Palace, just south of London, on the evening of January 6th, Epiphany. And there, where tradition dictated, the royal household was entertained by a series of mummers' plays that went on from all over the place. They were to either capture or assassinate the king and as many members of the royal family as possible. The London Lollards were therefore scheduled to play the most crucial part in Oldcastle's conspiracy. They were the strike team that would paralyse the nation so that a few nights later, the Lollards, as they gathered, would be in a position to be supplemented by a massive amount of Lollards from London and then purge the church in the city and then the rest of the country. It was a brilliant plan, daring in its simplicity. But on the 5th of January, just as it was about to take place, two of the members of this core group of assassins lost their nerve and revealed the plot to the government. One was called John de Burgh, and he was a carpenter from London. The other was Thomas Skeatford. And for this, by the way, they were each granted a life pension of 10 marks for their services. As a result of these revelations, the king alerted William Cromer, the mayor of London, warning him to arrest all suspicious persons and to order each alderman to keep a special watch in his own ward. And that evening on the 5th, the mayor himself went, quote, at about 10 o'clock at night, with a strong power, to the sign of the axe without Bishopgate, where they apprehended the men of the house owned by John Burgate, carpenter, and seven others, one of whom being a squire belonging to Oldcastle, unquote. These seven men were the party of conspirators which, quote, had cast to have made a mummerage at Eltham, and under colour of the mummerage to have destroyed the king and holy church, unquote. The strike force aimed to kill the king had been arrested. The members of this group were brought before the king at Eltham, where they confessed to being, quote, confederated with Oldcastle, unquote, and reveal the plans for a large-scale muster of Lollards in St. Giles Field. The identity of the esquire who was taken, we can't actually establish fully, but we think it could have been Robert Hayley of London, who was executed immediately after the rising. It is probable that by this time, and from this source, the king was informed of Oldcastle's hiding place. And it's about now that a yeoman called John Barton and his fellows were sent to watch and spy on, quote, one house in Smithfield, which was William Patchmaner's house, where indeed John Oldcastle was lodged, unquote. After keeping an eye on the house, they then moved in. All they found, however, was a number of Lollard books that belonged to Patchmaner. But despite these efforts, Patchmaner and Oldcastle had flown. According to Patchmaner's indictment, he and Sir John had left the house on the evening of January 5th, probably at the first suspicion that something had gone wrong in the city. This would account for them not being there when the constables had searched the house and found the books. At this stage, Oldcastle may have transferred his headquarters to a Smithfield Inn called the Wrestler on the Hope. We don't know where the Wrestler of the Hope was precisely, and we're not 100% sure he was there. Certainly, this inn was a gathering place for the incoming Lollard contingents from around the country. Some of the Derbyshire Lollards were heard to say before they left home that when they reached London, they would go to the Wrestler on the Hope to receive orders. And John Cock, one of the Essex rebel leaders, distributed wages to his men there. But be that as it may, Whether by accident or design, the authorities apparently did not raid the Wrestler and the Hope before the muster on St. Giles Field, and we don't even know the name of the landlord of the inn. On the 7th of January, the day after the arrest of the plotters at the Sign of the Axe, the King issued a writ to the sheriffs throughout England, ordering them to make proclamation against making, procuring, or attending any unlawful assemblies whatsoever. The document went on to say that certain Lollards had voluntarily confessed that they and others of their sect had planned to make such assemblies all over their realm, quote, to the destruction of the Catholic faith, of the King's person, and the estate of the lords and great men of the realm, spiritual and temporal, unquote. It is plain that by now Oldcastle's plan were fully known to the government, and it must have also been equally clear to Sir John that one part of his scheme had failed and the remaining part had lost the element of surprise. But he did not call off the revolt. If I'm going to be honest, I don't think he could have. Most of the Lollards who were going to be involved were on the roads to London. Some must have already arrived at the capital. The die was cast. The actions of King Henry V at this time, however, need to be considered because he did make a difference. We know that on January 8th, the King and his lords rode through London on their way from Eltham, where they'd been based, to Westminster. Now, Westminster was easily seen as the best place for operations against the rebels, because if they're going to meet at St. Giles Field, that's halfway between the cities of London and Westminster. Though the King's move through the city was made deliberately, quote, without noise and modestly, unquote, the London Lollards must have been somewhat aware of the preparations being made against them and their co-believers. And this probably caused some degree of demoralisation. At least one Londoner, a carpenter called Thomas Cornville, thought it safest to voluntarily give himself up to the mayor on the 9th of January. Meanwhile, the King, stirred up by news that the Lollards intended on destroying the houses of the London friars, as well as the monasteries of Westminster, St. Paul's and St. Albans, he decided to attack them during the night of the 9th and the 10th, and so to disperse them before they could do any damage. Now, this decision was made against the advice of some of his councillors, amongst whom many favoured waiting until daylight because, quote, so that they could distinguish who wanted to stand with the king or against the lord, unquote, while others advised him to wait for reinforcements before attacking the Lollards because they'd heard that they're expecting 25,000 of them. King Henry wasn't listening. The king, quote, took the field near St. John's Priory, Clerkenwell, not long after midnight. He was accompanied by his brother, by Archbishop Arundel, and by the Earl of Warwick and many other lords. According to some reports, he had carried before him a banner bearing a cross, unquote. The king's location near St. John's Priory was actually perfect, as it allowed him to intercept any rebel contingents coming towards St. Giles Field from the north, and it was also close to Smithfield, where he knew Oldcastle was based in his headquarters somewhere along the way. Meanwhile, he sent out other parties to, quote, to keep the where the ways about London, unquote. The king's in a good position. He's acted boldly. He's acted well. But he also had good reason to expect that whatever forces were marching in, the mainstay of Oldcastle's revolution was going to be the London Lollards. And in order to prevent any rebels in the city from joining their fellows on St. Giles Field, he ordered, quote, that the city gate should be closed and guarded by armed men, so that no one could leave except with whom they knew would hurry to the royal standards, unquote. Now, this, more than anything, was to shape the revolt to come, at least two contemporaries. One suggested that had he not taken this action, quote, they had come out of the slaves and apprentices together with some of their fellow citizens and masters to the number of 50,000 against the king, unquote. And this account goes on to say that the non-appearance of the London contingent was one of the major factors for the demoralisation and the defeat of the rebels. Quote, they were even more dismayed because they saw no one coming from London, where they thought thousands would rush to their aid, unquote. Now, while this chronicle is clearly guilty of gross exaggeration, I mean, he claims there's going to be 50,000 Lollards marching out. There isn't 50,000 in the city at this time. But it's probably true that there was genuinely a sizable force of Londoners who originally intended to join the rebels in St. Giles Field under the command of their patron, Oldcastle. The city's Lollards, however, must have already been severely shaken by the failure of the Eltham plot and the resultant arrests of John Burgate and others, so that the appearance of armed men at the walls and gates must have been for many of them the final straw and caused the majority of them to return to their homes and lie low until the danger had passed. Even so, nearly about 40 Londoners, several of whom significantly came from the districts outside of the walls, did apparently manage to take part in the rising. The failure to appear of the promised larger contingent, together with the news of the partial failure of the conspiracy, must have been a heavy blow to the incoming country rebels, adding further to their sense of confusion and panic. We have no detailed description of the events of the night of the 9th and 10th of January that year, and the only eyewitness who left us any account is really, unfortunately, brief. He gives us a picture of the king and his armed retainers waiting under a starry sky for the rebels to appear. They witnessed a comet, a shooting star, across the sky, which some took as an omen for the downfall of the Lollards. What we do know, however, was that many of the Lollards, quote, rushing from distant parts to the enemy camp, they first entered the royal camp by mistake, where when asked who they were complaining about, they answered their Lord of Cobham, wherefore against hope they were captured and committed to prison, unquote. Yeah, the king had put himself perfectly located to intercept the rebels who were supposedly marching to London to oppose him. There seems to have been relatively little fighting at all, and most of those rebels who avoided blundering into the royal camp in the darkness are reported to have fled once they heard that the king was in the field. I mean, amongst the fugitives, apart from Oldcastle himself, were at least three Londoners, a man called John Swepson, another called Gilbert Milbourne, and a vintner called John Spall, who were subsequently arrested in Oxford in the company of Walter Blake and the members of the Bristol contingent. It appears that these three had gone to give news of Oldcastle's uprising to Bristol's Lollards and were escorting them back as guides when they realised the jig was up. Other Lollards, perhaps more foolhardily or more determined, formed an ambushment at Haringey Park, just to the north of the city, perhaps hoping to counterattack the royal forces who were chasing their comrades. They, however, were soon rounded up, and their numbers included the Dunstable brewer William Morley. We're, unfortunately, almost completely ignorant of what part the London Lollards played in the night's events. By the morning of the 10th of January, the rising had been completely defeated and crushed. And later that day, a commission consisting of the Lord Mayor, two lords and three judges was set up to try the 80 rebels who had fallen into the king's hand and were now in the custody of the Earl Marshal. Amusingly enough, it's clear that in all the confusion on the 10th of January, several Londoners decided to exploit the situation, which is why on the 11th of January, the government was forced to order the city sheriffs to make sure everybody understand that no one was to arrest people, accuse them of Lollardy, and use that to take all their goods of them unless an order came from the king. Ah yes, London black artists seem to have genuinely used the crisis to help themselves to some property and chattels. On the same day, the commissioners sitting in Westminster tried a small number of the rebels. These included three Londoners, a fuller, a parchment maker and a mercer, and all of whom were sentenced to death and taken to the Tower to await execution, although all were in fact subsequently pardoned. 69 more were tried on the following day, Friday the 12th, and they were also sent to the Tower. In the evening, 12 of them were drawn to the streets to Newgate, where they were officially handed over to the sheriffs of London for execution. On Saturday the 13th of January, 25 more were drawn to Newgate, and then all 37 were dragged to St. Giles Field, where four new pairs of gallows, called the Lollard's Gallows, had been set up, quote, by the highway, unquote. One man, a London carpenter called Thomas Payer, seems to have received a last-minute reprieve, but the other 36 of them were hanged. And seven of them, who were accused of being Lollards as well as traitors and had refused to recant, were then burnt hanging, quote, gallows and all, unquote. One of those dealt with was William Morley, but the identity of the others is unknown, so that we do not know whether any Londoners were amidst them. At least nine Londoners, however, including Robert Hayley, Esquire, were amongst those executed on the 13th. On the following Monday, the 15th of January, the Archbishop of Canterbury ordered a grand procession to be made through the streets of London to give thanks for the King's victory, to pray for deliverance of England from heretics, and it had even a specially composed prayer for everybody to join in. The Archbishop plainly considered that the Lollard threat to his church was a very real one, and on the 21st of January he ordered further processions to be made in different churches and cathedrals around the country. Meanwhile, the London commissioners continued their work, and on the 16th of January they were granted license, quote, for this time only, unquote, to hold sessions in the Tower of London itself. And this is highly unusual and probably was only done for the making sure that the Lollard prisoners there could not escape. On the 19th, several more London rebels suffered execution at St. Giles's Field. These were the priest John Beverley, an anonymous text writer of St. John Street, Clerkenwell, a glover who lived round London Bridge, and, as well as that, one of the main plotters for the assassination attempt at Eltham, John Burgate. Their bodies are not reported to have been burnt hanging, so it's probable they'd not been convicted of heresy, just treason. The government could, however, deal leniently with those less deeply implicated in heresy and treason, and on the 23rd of January, the first of many royal pardons were granted, in this instance for the London fuller Henry Dean, who'd been condemned to death on the day after the rising. Finally, on the 8th of February, Sir Roger Acton, one of the main ringleaders of the rising, was convicted of treason, and 2 days later, he was drawn through the streets and hanged at St. Giles. The rebellion, the uprising, was over. It's difficult to arrive at any conclusions concerning the nature of the Lollards of London during this time. They seem on the whole to have been minor tradesmen of no great importance. Certainly none of them have known to have held any position within the city, although some seem to have been rarely prosperous. Of those 29 London Lollards wound up in the insurrection, and we know of their trades, 5 were weavers, 3 were carpenters, 3 parchment makers, 3 servants, 2 were scriveners, 2 mercers and 2 fullers. And there were individual examples of a brewer, a vintner, a hostler, a hosier, a glover and a tailor. Oldcastle himself escaped and may have remained in London for nearly a month after the failure of the rising. We have an account of an ex-soldier called Richard Mackerel, a highwayman and criminal, who claimed he'd returned from fighting in France in around the 2nd of February in 1414, but because he was wanted in London for debt, he'd taken refuge in the sanctuary of Westminster to avoid being arrested almost immediately. He and some fellow sanctuary men in and around the abbey had been approached to help escort Oldcastle out of the region for 20 shillings. In return for these wages, Mackerel and his comrades were to be given a horse and, accompanied by several people, were to then escort Sir John safely wherever he wished to go. Of course, that testimony and that story may have been entirely made up. It is interesting that we know that the authorities were still searching for Oldcastle in London a full month after the uprising. It seems likely that during the remainder of 1414, however, the London Lollards that did survive what happened were cowed by the suppression of the revolt and the execution in front of their faces of their leaders and comrades. Certainly we hear nothing about them until the late summer of 1415, when a number of London heretics were arrested by the city authorities and handed over to the Bishop of London's commissioners. Easily the most important of these was the veteran Lollard and former common councilman John Claydon, who on the 17th of August 1415 came up for trial at St. Paul's Chapter House before the Archbishop, several other bishops, and the Lord Mayor of London. He was found guilty and condemned to death. On September the 9th, 1415, the day before Claydon's execution, his associate, Richard Gumnin, a.k.a. Richard Baker, was also burnt at Smithfield. It was Claydon's execution, however. The pogrom against the Lollards of London seems to have reached its peak. Oldcastle had escaped, but the Lollards of London were now on a downward trajectory to diminish into nothing. The Oldcastle Rebellion was a strange moment. The Lollard movement suddenly went from being eccentric heretics to being violent revolutionary. And just as quickly as they enter our story as main players, they very quickly disappear. The true legacy of the Lollard movement was in the seeds it planted. Here was a growing militant anti-Catholic force of Christians. Here in the streets, the London faithful suddenly found a voice that was radical, that was Protestant. But as we said, the Protestants weren't to come for quite a while. But if there is one legacy of the rebellion of the Lollards and of Sir John Oldcastle, it was simply that here was planted the seeds that many years later would find fruit in the religious descent of the times to come. As for Sir John Oldcastle, he will eventually die. We will get to the story of his arrest and execution. Time passes, and many years later, William Shakespeare was to write an account of Henry V's life, which included a raucous account of Sir John Oldcastle. Unfortunately for him at the time, a descendant, Lord Cobham, did not wish for his ancestor to be included in such a salacious play. And so, fearing a lawsuit, Shakespeare changed the name of Oldcastle to Sir John Falstaff. The rest kind of is history. Oldcastle himself was nothing like Falstaff. He wasn't a drunk. He was a man of action, a soldier, and eventually a revolutionary. But with that, we're going to leave this little two-chapter excursion of the Lollard story there. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week. I hope you enjoyed it as we carry on with the story of London. And we're rapidly approaching the rather exciting Battle of Agincourt. See you then. Bye.